On the program today, a bunch of money stuff, refinancing and credit cards and credit unions versus banks. Oh, and how we were actually not ready for some football. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, April 3rd. Good to have you with us. Now, funnily enough, the last time I sat in this chair for Kai, we talked about how mortgage rates were dropping, and that was good news for the spring home buying season. See, I pay attention. And as it happens, those dropping rates have also kicked off a wave of refinancing. Homeowners are happy. A report from analysts Black Knight says some 5 million people could end up saving hundreds of dollars a month each. But what about the banks who make those loans? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports they're hustling.
The last couple years have been tough for mortgage lenders. With interest rates around 5%, refinancing hit a 20-year low. Many lenders had to downsize, with mortgage departments at J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo losing hundreds of jobs. Then, last week,
rates are continuing to fall today, edging very close to the 3% range on the 30-year fix.
Interest rates dropped for the fourth straight week, and the phones started ringing.
We're definitely fielding more calls. We've definitely seen the increase in activity, but hey, that's what we're here for, right? We love that.
Avi Misrahi is a lender with Cross Country Mortgage in Boca Raton, Florida. He says the staff can handle the current load, but if the trend continues into the summer, they may need more help. Refinance applications shot up almost 40% last week to their highest level in more than 2 years, according to Joel Kahn with the Mortgage Bankers Association.
This is a big deal because we're actually seeing borrowers come back to the market.
Particularly borrowers with bigger loans who bought in the last couple years when interest rates were on the high end. But will it really be enough to spur more hiring in the mortgage industry? Karen Petru with Federal Financial Analytics isn't so sure.
I think the expectation is that this is just a blip.
Mortgage rates have already started bouncing back up this week, with more increases predicted later in the year. So mortgage rate watchers might want to keep their seatbelts buckled and be ready for more bumps. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Let's continue on this topic of America's favorite pastime, debt. Delta Airlines has renewed its partnership with American Express to bring consumers branded SkyMiles credit cards through 2029. Delta made $3.4 billion off its credit cards last year alone. That's a lot of money no matter what. It's also more than half of the air carrier's overall profit. And Delta estimates its re-up with Amex will bring in something like $7 billion a year by 2023, by which time I assume it will be a credit card company with an airline attached. Marketplace's Renata Sego has more.
Everybody wants to go somewhere someday. That's the allure of travel. People also love a deal and perks to get to their destinations, which is why, according to travel analyst Gary Leff, any products that make consumers feel like they're earning something, anything, toward their travel are valuable to airlines. Take frequent flyer miles.
Airlines sell more frequent flyer miles than they award to passengers flying on their planes.
The biggest customers buying those miles? Credit card companies, which incentivize their customers by giving them miles for the dollars they spend.
They are multi-billion dollar deals.
Delta and Amex have 7 co-branded credit cards. Leff says other air carriers are also making big bucks out of credit card products.
In the case of American Airlines, they're actually making so much money that it represents the entirety of their profit for last year.
Henry Hardeveld worked on the first co-branded airline credit card for Continental Airlines back in the 80s. Now he runs Atmosphere Research Group. He says the key to profit there is that airline and credit card companies have succeeded in making people feel comfortable using their credit cards for everyday and not so everyday spending.
People put mortgage down payments on their credit cards. They put education bills on their credit cards.
And they rack up those airline miles, which they can use for their next trip to, say, Belize. And in the meantime, the airlines and the credit card companies are also racking up the cash. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, get ready to do a little chair dance. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those mortgage rates may be low, but there are still millions of renters out there, and landlords are trying to woo them with all sorts of new conveniences, including smart home technology. Things like connected door locks for keyless entry, or security cameras, or connected thermostats that help keep utility bills down. Seems cool, right? But maybe not if you care about your privacy. Leslie Carhart is a data security expert in Chicago, Illinois, and when her landlord said her building was getting smart locks, her spidey sense went up. She wrote a blog post about it, and we called her to talk about it. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So tell me about your experience, the experience that kind of kicked off your initial blog post. Your landlord wanted to make your apartment smart, right? And you weren't sure that you wanted that?
Yes. I rent from a large property management company in the United States, and I got an email one day saying, "We're going to make your apartment smart. It's exciting news. Good news for everybody." And I'm a cybersecurity professional, and there was some keywords right there that made me very concerned.
Such as, it's going to be great.
So first of all, it's going to be great. But also, they mentioned a smart lock immediately and being able to grant access to one's apartment via an app on a smartphone. And both of those are a little concerning because all of a sudden we've gone from a physical key, which is something you have, to a code, which is something you know, which somebody else can learn over time. It's a little bit easier to transfer than a physical key.
Let's do the sort of pros and cons. Why might it be good for a property manager and a tenant to have a smart apartment?
So there's a lot of good reasons for implementing this technology. First of all, it makes it easier for rental properties to manage and maintain the units, especially when they're unoccupied. They can do things like monitor for water leaks, make sure that the right people have access to the unit when they're showing it off to potential new tenants. They can also make a added convenience for their users, which is a good sell for potential residents. You can change your temperature from your phone. You can grant access to people when you're not home and know who's accessing your apartment when.
All right. And then how about the cons, ranging from actual security, physical security, to privacy?
So I often tell people that in terms of security, things can be quick, cheap, secure, but not all three at once. And in this case, the industry is asking for this to be implemented quickly and cheaply. And consumers really need to be asking for security here for multiple reasons. First of all, you're sending a tremendous amount of data about the way that you live, who's home, when you're home, when you go to work. You're sending that out over the internet to multiple parties, and you would ostensibly want to send that securely. And also, the lock, of course, is granting access to your apartment.
So, broadly speaking, how big a business is this? I think... It was in reading your post that I realized there's literally an industry around smart apartment tech. There are companies set up to sort of be the middleman, right, between property management companies and, I guess, vendors of security products?
There is, and it was a lot of homework for me because I wasn't aware of that either. And I did a lot of looking into conferences in the property management industry and also into the various companies. And there are multiple companies offering this technology. So they supply the hardware like smart hubs and smart locks to the property management company. And they also act as that middleman who sends the data from the hub to the apps that the end users like the residents use, and also as needed to the property management company so that they can do their management and monitoring of the units.
Where did you land in terms of feeling okay about moving forward with this?
I'm buying a house.
Uh-huh.
And that's not my threat model isn't everybody's. I'm a security researcher. I catch bad hackers for a living. And the last thing I need in my life is a system that could be monitored or tampered with by one of the people who I sent to prison or got in trouble with the law in some other way. I just can't deal with that within the contents of my own personal threat model. Other people will feel differently, and they have very, very different threat models. But it's important to think about these issues because a lot of people don't have a choice whether to rent or not to rent.
Leslie Carhart is a security researcher and blogger. Thanks so much for the time.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've got a link to Leslie's blog post at our website, marketplace.org. Credit unions are only supposed to serve certain communities, like firefighters or military members or people who work in aviation, that kind of thing. And because of that, they get to sidestep federal income taxes. But the U.S. government has made membership restrictions a lot looser than they used to be, and credit union membership has shot up by almost 60% over the past 20 years. Traditional banks are not happy. The two sides have fought about this on Capitol Hill, in federal district court, and soon in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on that.
You can get a sense of how easy it is to join a credit union these days through three people I met up with at a cafe in College Park, Maryland. Ayla Hurley joined the Navy Federal Credit Union about 5 years ago. Hurley works in IT. She's not in the Navy. But her roommate had family in the military and belonged to Navy Federal. Turns out, if you're living with a member, you can join too. Hurley remembers thinking,
"That's it? Okay, great. It was very surprising how easy it was."
A year later, Hurley got a new roommate, Sterling Huber, also not in the military, also wanting to join Navy Federal. He just had to type in Hurley's account number.
"That's the one I'm connected to, roommate, and that was it."
Then Huber asked his friend, software engineer Matt Lindsay, to move in, and he wanted to join Navy Federal, too.
"I had no idea how many layers deep we were by the time I actually got to sign up for Navy Federal."
Daisy chains like this one are a relatively new phenomenon. In the past, to join a credit union, you had to work for a particular company. First Congress, then federal regulators made joining easier. They wanted to make credit union benefits available to more people. Credit unions save their members around $12 billion a year, according to an industry trade group. Its chief lobbyist, Ryan Donovan, says that
through lower fees on products, lower interest rates charged on loan products, higher returns on savings.
Credit unions can afford to do that because they don't pay federal income taxes. They're nonprofits, restricted to serving their members. Donovan says half the mortgages credit unions issue go to middle or low-income families. Credit unions are small, not giving J.P. Morgan Chase anything to worry about, but they do compete with smaller community banks, like Sound Community Bank in Seattle. CEO Lori Stewart says credit union loan rates are as much as a percentage point lower than what she can offer.
"I've had customers call me, and I've had to say to that client, if you can get that rate and term, take it."
Ironically, Sound Community Bank used to be a credit union for grocery store workers. That was before the membership rules were loosened. It became a bank because its membership was drying up. Stewart says if the limits were as loose then as they are now, she would have taken advantage of them, and her bank would have remained a credit union.
"We'd have put a sign out and said, come in the door. Come and get a mortgage loan. Let me help you, small business."
The last member of the Navy Federal membership, Daisy Chain, Matt Lindsay, says he'll get his girlfriend to join. He says the process she'll go through seems like a ridiculous formality at this point.
"It was so easy, it makes me wonder why they even bother anymore. Like, why do we have to do any step of this process other than saying, like, I want to be in your credit unit?"
The banks would like the process to be harder for people like Matt Lindsay and his girlfriend. That's one of the points the bank's lawyers will make when they face off against the credit unions in federal appeals court later this month. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there is not representation at the level that one might expect or hope for.
Bringing diversity to real estate development in Chicago. But first, let's do the numbers. Dance with me. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 39.1% to close at 26,218. The NASDAQ found 46.6% to finish at 78.95. And the S&P 500 rose 6.2% to end at 28.73. Some computer chip makers surged today. Advanced Micro Devices clicked up 8.4%. And Intel announced it hired a new CFO, George Davis, who comes from rival Qualcomm. Dishy. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.52%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want to tell you about another podcast from Marketplace. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This season goes deep inside the war on drugs because to understand how we've handled the opioid crisis so far, you need to go back in history, starting 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush held up an actual baggie of crack cocaine during his first national televised speech. There is, though, a strange backstory to where that baggie of crack came from, and it's a moment we've been dealing with ever since. The new season is out now. Listen and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour, wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. China has very strict food and consumer safety laws. Companies can be fined thousands of dollars for things like expired foods or poor labeling. And whoever reports those infractions can actually get a reward. And where there is economic incentive, there will be a market. In this case, professional shoppers who are on the hunt for bad food. Here's Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pak shopping in Beijing.
Wang Hai calls himself a market scavenger. His hunting ground is at supermarkets like this one at an upmarket mall. He picks up a tiny red container, bird's nest soup, a delicacy people eat for good health and skin, on sale for $68.
This bird's nest soup contains 99% sugar water. We've tested it before.
We turn onto an aisle filled with imported foods, generally thought to be better than local products. But Wang Hai says import doesn't always mean safe. Last year, he took a TV news team to check imported biscuits at supermarkets in southern China.
The expiration date on these biscuits shows 2018. But once we use an ultraviolet light, we can see the original date beneath. The products expired 2 years earlier, in 2016.
When Wang Hai finds or gets consumer tips about bad or fake goods, he buys in bulk and demands compensation from the retailer. He's been doing this since the mid-90s, when China enacted its first consumer protection law with a punitive clause.
If the consumer finds there is fraud when buying a product or service, then the consumer is entitled to a full refund, plus compensation equal to the price of the item.
And if it's a food product, the compensation is now up to 10 times the price. Plus, whistleblowers can also get a reward for alerting regulators, which is problematic, says Jake Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council in Beijing.
One of our companies gave us an example of an employee that would enter into the store. They used a chemical solvent to remove the expiration dates on bottles of alcohol.
And the food safety law has very strict guidelines about expiration dates.
The individual who discovered this problem reported it to the company, sought money from the company with a threat that they would take this information to the local food safety regulator who would likely impose fines.
He says a fine is at least $14,000 for each infraction. And while the American company successfully fought back, it took a lot of time and money.
There are thousands of complaints like this every year.
But Wang Hai says that's not how he operates. He says he's in the business of consumer rights protection, which he finds weak in China.
Because many company bosses are the National People's Congress representatives who make the laws.
His team has uncovered fake alcohol, fake sales, even fake hospitals. And exposing these scams has earned him a good sum, almost $900,000, just for finding shops that carry smuggled beef.
If the money was for one person, that would be considered a lot. But I have a team of 20 people. The office rent is $74,000 a year, and we have to hire lawyers, pay for travel. All of that costs money.
He's lobbying the government to give whistleblowers even bigger rewards. In Beijing, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
I hope you didn't get too attached to the Alliance of American Football, the latest professional football league that debuted to great fanfare and has played 8 games since February, because now it's apparently over. AAF leadership told the league's 8 teams in a conference call yesterday that it is suspending operations just 3 weeks before its regular season was supposed to end. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports on why alternatives to the NFL always end up punting.
It wasn't the TV ratings that did the league in. Nielsen said both games its first week averaged almost 3 million viewers. Not NFL numbers, but still pretty good. It was something else.
The league did not have the funding necessary to sustain it.
Daniel Kaplan writes about football for the Sports Business Journal. He says after the first week of games, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes in the National Hockey League bought the AAF by agreeing to cover all of its operating expenses. He wanted the league to establish a formal relationship with the NFL, a pipeline of players from the big league's practice squads. But the NFL wasn't having it. Stefan Szymański teaches sports management at the University of Michigan.
The NFL doesn't just stand idly by and say, oh, well, if there's competition, all well and good. They're actually actively planning to defeat the competition, and they have a lot of weapons at their command.
The NFL didn't respond to a request for comment before deadline. Szymański says the most important weapon at the NFL's disposal is its talent feeder system. Maury Brown runs BizBall, a sports analytics company.
The best college players that are tracked by fans during their college days are going to transition to the NFL.
But that's not stopping other startup leagues from trying to compete. Vince McMahon sold $272 million in WWE stock to relaunch the XFL, the same league he tried to sell fans in 2001. It lasted one season. The XFL will relaunch next year, the weekend after the Super Bowl. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The big news this week in Chicago, a new mayor. Lori Lightfoot won big by promising, among other things, equity for residents of that city. One thing the new city government might do is make sure development projects create more benefits for groups that often get left out of such deals, like a controversial new housing project where developers want a $900 million city tax subsidy. If it's approved, it'll probably come with conditions. From WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
A steel plant and other industrial buildings used to occupy a stretch of land on Chicago's north side, about 5 miles northwest of downtown. Today, it's empty, fenced off with a keep out, no trespassing sign. Developer Sterling Bay wants to transform this 55 acres into a place called Lincoln Yards, a bustling community with thousands of housing units, retail, and commerce. Too often, projects like this are exclusionary, says Calmetta Coleman of the Chicago Urban League.
All you have to do is really walk around the city and take a look at any sort of construction site, and you'll see that there is not representation at the level that one might expect or hope for African Americans. If you look at who's actually working on those sites, if you look at who's getting the contracts, it's just not in a place where there is the opportunity for the kind of equity across all ethnic groups.
So let's talk more numbers for a minute. The Lincoln Yards cost is estimated at $6 billion. The city council says that for it to approve the nearly $1 billion subsidy the developer wants, it would require 26% of the contracts go to certified minority-owned businesses and 6% to certified women-owned businesses. Kendra Dinkins is president and owner of Taylor Electric, a fourth-generation family company. But Dinkins, who's African-American, says on projects as large as Lincoln Yards, the bureaucracy can be hard for minority or women-owned contractors.
Sometimes with larger projects and more people involved and more layers you put on top of it, that's more and more people that have to approve things, and it takes a little bit longer.
Dinkins is on the Diversity Advisory Council for Lincoln Yards. The Chicago Urban League is watching, but not on board yet. One of the major criticisms of Lincoln Yards is that resources would be poured into a wider, wealthier part of town that doesn't need subsidized development. but the developer says the whole city will benefit. Shelley Burke directs community engagement and diversity compliance at Sterling Bay.
The economic and workforce opportunities that will be created by the development will reach all of Chicago, including the South and West Sides.
Sterling Bay estimates 24,000 permanent jobs at Lincoln Yards, plus 10,000 jobs a year for 10 years during construction. Rachel Weber is an urban planning and policy professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She says the city's minority contracting program has a long history of scandals around front companies.
Not actually being minority or women owned, but, you know, sort of putting the name of somebody up who's the CEO, who's maybe not really involved in the day-to-day activities.
Sterling Bay officials say they will monitor that. The city council hasn't scheduled a vote on the project yet. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore for Marketplace.
This final note before we go is about Patagonia, the unlikely creator of one of the most stereotypical bro uniforms the world has ever seen, the logo fleece vest. It's so common on Wall Street that it's often called the Midtown uniform, which, by the way, is an Instagram account you should follow immediately. But now Patagonia says it's not making deals with just any old company anymore. Patagonia is shifting its corporate sales program to work with companies that are mission-driven and, quote, prioritize the planet. One financial services company already posted its Patagonia rejection letter. All right, we got to go. The Dow was up 39 points today. That's a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ found 46 points, 0.6%. And the S&P 500 rose 6 points. That was 0.2%. Our media production team includes Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. And I'm Molly Wood. Have a lovely evening. We'll be right back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.